Good afternoon, good evening again. This is Veronica Entwistle, and you've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. We have a few people on the planet, maybe a lot more than a few, who are fortunately pushing the envelope and creating some kind of contribution that's going to help the collective. And we have a wonderful being today, Tim Costello, who started an organization called Slum Doctor. And Tim is from my hometown, Bellingham, Washington. Welcome, Tim. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Hi. We want to know a lot about you and how you got going. So I know that you've worked with AIDS and hospice in Bellingham and for quite a long time now, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, for 20 years.
Oh, well, so tell us a little
including,
bit.
Including, actually, my original work as an AIDS activist began in New York City.
Wow. So I want to, well, I just want to say quickly that Tim moved from doing Bellingham organization into working with African communities, mostly in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, is that right? East Africa?
Yes, Kenya and Uganda.
All right, so let's hear how you got started in the AIDS thing at all. Who are you? Where did you start out? Where did you come from?
Well, that sounded like a simple question, but I think it's really complicated. And
that,
I mean,
the,
who knows?
That's the human mystery, isn't it?
Right. Who knows why our lives take us down certain paths? But anyway, mine has happened to coincide with AIDS over the past 20 years, and originally, in the 80s, I lived in New York City, and at the time, that was the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic in the United States, and I had recently recovered from being sick for a very long time with cancer, and was very sensitized to illness because of that, and you know, the suffering that goes with it, and here was this epidemic that hit New York City, and all these people around me were dying, and those of us that are old enough to remember back 20 years ago
sure remember that it was horrendous.
Yeah, the hysteria, the discrimination, the not even knowing what was causing this illness, to you know, which led me and a lot of other activists on a path to trying to end the discrimination, trying to find a cure for the disease, which still has not yet to be found. And
well, look, can I interrupt you just for a second?
Sure.
What kind, are you willing to say what type of cancer you had?
I had lymphoma.
Uh-huh.
I had a tumor. The medical profession loves to describe tumors and compare them to fruit. And mine was a grapefruit. It was the size of a grapefruit, and it was around my heart, actually.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So
it's funny, because I always say you're a guy of a tremendous heart.
Oh, thank you.
So there was some connection there, isn't there?
Well, that grapefruit is gone, so I think my heart is at least has room to grow.
Well, it probably broke your heart enough to give it some room to grow, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So carry on. So you were healing by the time this AIDS epidemic hit.
I was, and mm-hmm. and I went to the very first meeting of the very first AIDS activist organization in this country called ACT UP, because my best friend had AIDS, and he asked me to go, and it was something, it was a moment I'll never forget, because there were over 100, mostly men, in a room, and there was almost a smell to the room of fear and desperation, but we've found each other, and we're angry, and we're mobilized, and we're going to do something about this, and it was the beginning of what is now a pretty historical time, and the ACT UP organization is considered a model for social change, and we were very effective in making some pretty rapid changes in the healthcare system and how people were treated, and eventually bringing services to people, but we also created, not unlike hospice, a model of care to take care of our friends who are dying every week, and trying to do that and keep people in their homes and out of the hospitals, which were terrible places for people with AIDS at the time. And we changed all that, to make a long story short. And one of the things that I bring from that time, besides the sad memories and...
You must have lost a lot of friends, did you?
I lost a lot of friends, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a real war, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really unbelievable, and I was a young man at the time, and it wasn't what you're supposed to be dealing with as a young person.
No.
And we had no role models for how to deal with it, so we became the role models. And that's something I'm very proud of, and also the memories are sad, but they're also memories of really strong, smart, beautiful people that died too young, and I carry their memories forward to this day in the work that I now do in Africa.
Excellent. So how did you get going in Bellingham? You went from New York to Bellingham?
I did. I moved. To tell you the truth, I got burnt out on AIDS work, mm-hmm. and I moved to Bellingham, which is where I went to college. And I had good friends here, and it's peaceful and green and beautiful and quiet. And I thought, okay.
It's a wonderful town, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great place. And I thought, okay, I'm done. I'm an artist. I'm just going to be an artist, and I'm done with AIDS, and that chapter is over. And I moved to Bellingham, and
that's
I really
right,
did.
Because you have a Bachelor of Fine Arts, don't
I
you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really did take a year off, and then I started volunteering for hospice.
Hmm.
And hospice, they knew my background, and there were people with AIDS in this small community, and still there were no drugs for people for AIDS at that time, and if you had an AIDS diagnosis, you were dead within 2 years, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So they assigned me the local AIDS patients through the hospice organization. So that began my journey again with this, I don't know what to say about this disease. It's such a metaphor for so much of the human condition.
Talk a bit about that, please.
Well, I think that's why I'm still able to do this work and still feel so strongly about it, because of the relationships that I have had through doing this work. But also the terrible injustice that goes with this disease. It's simply a medical condition, but there's this whole social overlay of, and especially I see this so much in Africa now, it's more than a disease. It has to do, speaking now of my work in Africa, it's so connected to poverty and the inequality of women, and now the 12 million children in Africa who are in the wake of this disease, who are orphaned because what has happened to the women, and it goes on, and the stigma that's associated with it, and the lack of dignity that people deserve to have for anyone's life.
And of course, there's this other thing about dignity, because I heard stories like this of women who are asking their husbands to use condoms,
right.
and the husbands beating them because it was a transgression of their, in quotes, dignity, of their rights, or whatever it is that their culture had honored before. I mean, all of this disease is ripping that apart, isn't it?
Yeah, and there, yeah, it's a really good point, because there's a lot of violence against women in the world, of course, but in Africa, it's pretty rampant. And when I say these things, I'm generalizing to a certain amount of truth. But I don't want to leave an impression that, like, a stereotype of a place. So just to be clear about that. But there is a lot of violence against women, and one of the risk factors for HIV is being married. And so thinking that marriage...
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that marriage is monogamous, supposedly, in this culture. It may or may not be in that culture. And so women who would like to use condoms even with their husbands can't oftentimes bring that subject up because they will be perceived as they've been the ones that have stepped outside of the marriage.
Mm.
Or why are they not trusting their husband? But as it turns out, in most cases, the husband does bring HIV to the wife in the marriage, and she is the one that's been faithful, and he has not. So,
mm-hmm. And then they both die? Or?
Yeah, and usually the husband dies first because he was infected first, leaves the wife and mother with no income and the children, and then she dies. So, yeah, and it goes on and on.
It's hard to even think of what to say, isn't it?
Well, the scale of it is really unimaginable, and I go to Africa every year, and I witness it with my own eyes, and there's just part of my imagination that can never grasp it, can never fully understand it.
So are you finding some results there? Are there positive things going on? I notice here that you have a whole list of programs that you're involved in over there, which is much more optimistic feeling.
Well, and it's the only approach I can take, and that's one of some kind of emergence of hope. And we're a small grassroots organization, and my belief is that work at the grassroots level is the only kind of work that's effective. And our work is based on relationships with people on the ground there who are truly the experts in what they do and also the heroes. And we simply partner with them to make their work more effective and to be able to reach more people. So there is a tremendous amount of hope and on that very intimate and personal level because these are individual lives. And we have 5 programs in Kenya and Uganda, and I know all the people that we serve, and I have met the AIDS widows, and I've met many of our AIDS patients, and I've held many of the children that are orphans that we either feed or send to school, this sort of thing. So that's the inspiration for me, and seeing the difference between a life that doesn't have hope and a life that has hope is really, really quite profound, and everyone deserves that. So that's what keeps me going. But then on the more macro level, there really is a shift of consciousness, I think, on that continent. I mean, I'm most familiar with Kenya and Uganda, where they are finally addressing this disease. The countries don't have strong healthcare systems or enough money to support it, really. But just from 3 years ago when I was there, no one was getting treatment for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And now I would say it's still a huge problem of access to treatment for HIV in those countries, but thousands and thousands of more people have access to medications. And
well, how are you making the difference, Tim? How are you making the change in human consciousness that it's going to take quite a bit of that, isn't it?
Well, I think, that's, I hesitate because that seems like, I just feel like one small, ordinary person who has been fortunate enough to live in Bellingham, Washington, to mobilize our community around the work that we do and to be able to affect several hundred people's lives in Kenya and Uganda. So, I'm a humble person, and I just think that's the difference, that the difference is in those lives. But on the other hand, we can be a model, I think, for change for other communities, because really, I'm a plain old middle-aged white guy in a small town in the Pacific Northwest doing work halfway around the globe. I had no idea what I was doing when I started 7 years ago, and that's the truth.
How did you get to Africa from Bellingham?
I got a scholarship to attend the International AIDS Conference in South Africa in the year 2000.
Wow.
And that was a defining moment for me because I was doing AIDS work in my community and thinking, that's my calling, this is what I've been doing for a long time, this is what I know. And we're really getting somewhere, you know, in this country and in this community where we have medicine for people. And there, I know people now who've been HIV positive for over 20 years and they're still alive. And we have social services. And we have.
And is the quality of life okay for those people?
The quality of life here?
Yeah, when you've been HIV for 20 years and you're in Medicaid.
Well, I can't speak to that because I'm not HIV positive, but I think there are huge challenges to your quality of life and taking medications. However, you know, every single day for the rest of your life because there is no cure. But, you know, I think it depends on how you see your life, you know, how you see your life with the challenges that you have. So I can't speak for them, but they are alive.
Hmm.
And I feel like what we have accomplished in this country is really a birthright for everyone around the world. I know when I had cancer, I lived in New York City, and you know, the best doctors in the world are there, or they have access to the best doctors in the world. And I worked for a corporation that had health insurance, so I'm very clear that I am alive because I'm American. Mm-hmm. You know, I was actually given a 6-month death sentence at the time, and that didn't turn out to be true. But my health care was paid for. I had access to the best health care, and that is only because of where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And in a place, and so that's a certain destiny, but I think that destiny belongs to the rest of the world. You know, healthcare is a basic right, and this is what Slum Doctor Program does, is we're basically just meeting the basic needs of people that wouldn't get met otherwise.
Now, you know, I was reading through all your paperwork here, you know, from the internet, and it seems to me I read, and I can't put my hand on it right now, but it said that something like one treatment is something like 50 cents over there? That can't be true here.
That is, that relates, no, that's not true here.
No, so there is a difference in drug therapy and so on.
Yeah, and I think what you were reading is, we have a cervical cancer screening program.
Oh, that's right.
At an HIV clinic that we helped start in partnership with some people on the ground in Nairobi and also the University of Washington. It's now the largest free HIV clinic in Kenya. And what we recently added to that clinic this year was a cervical cancer screening program for all the HIV-positive women at that clinic. And there are over 2,000 women who seek treatment at that clinic. It's entirely free, their HIV treatment, and plus we're funding the cervical cancer screening program.
Wow,
and
excellent.
It's 50 cents
excellent.
To screen women for the number one killing cancer in Kenya and most developing countries in the world.
Is there a tie-in with HIV and cervical cancer?
There is. There's a greater co-infection rate. I think it's about 20 to 30%. Don't quote me on that. But mm-hmm. for women with HIV, they're at a much greater risk for cervical mm-hmm. cancer. So I feel really strongly that, you know, we've worked this hard over the years, the last 3 years, to get this clinic up and running, and we're keeping women alive. And men, too, and their children. They're regaining their health. They're able to go back to work, and if they have a job, and prevent their children from being orphans. But we don't want to lose them to cervical cancer.
No, for sure.
I'm really proud of that program.
Good. Well, wonderful. Let's talk about the other programs as well. I have several directions in which I want to go here.
Okay.
And one of them is kind of spiritual, metaphysical. Are you up for that a little bit later?
Sure.
But in the meantime, I'd like to go through the projects. I'm flipping through my paper here. I keep pulling my face away from the microphone. But you have a number of interesting projects. One is, obviously emergency medical care for AIDS patients. But there's one about a girls' academy.
Right.
Do you want to talk about the various programs you've got?
Sure. And that's a boarding school for high school girls in western Kenya. And it's in the poorest district of Kenya and also the hardest hit by HIV. There's a 30% adult infection rate
wow.
in that area. So again, you can imagine the population of orphans in that area.
So these orphan children, the Girls' Academy, are they all without parents?
Yeah. Well, they're not all without parents, but the ones that we support, and we support 50 girls to get a high school education at this school, and we link them with sponsors, I was going to say in Bellingham, but they're not just from the Bellingham area. And for $800 a year, we can keep a girl in school, and really, I have to say, young girls are really vulnerable, especially if you're orphans, in that culture. And so they're in a safe environment. They're getting an education, and they're getting fed. And then we also pay all their school fees and buy their uniform and their textbooks and get them feminine hygiene products and sandals and shoes and very basic. We meet their very basic needs throughout the year. So, for
this is the time to give your website so that if anybody wants to donate, they can. This show is not just about gathering donations, but they're sure welcome.
Sure. And that website is www.slumdoctor.org. slumdoctor.org.
Excellent. Well, that's wonderful. And now there's an orphanage here as well?
Yeah, we have an orphanage outside of Nairobi with 20 children that we support. And that's in response to a community as well who's lost a lot of parents. And you know, this you have to remember that this is in the context of extreme poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And African culture prefers to keep the child in the extended family. They have a communal culture. And so that the fact that there even is an orphanage is a sign of a desperate situation because they would prefer to keep the children in an auntie's home or a granny's home. And it's just not possible always. So we're supporting 20 kids, and that's a partnership with a Rotary Club in Kenya, and the kids are also getting an education, and they're being raised by these really great house mothers, and they're getting health care as well. So.
And how long? Oh, that started in 2006. So you don't have any great results yet, but it feels pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you what feels good is going to visit them. And getting swarmed by kids and hugged by kids and sung to by kids who have beautiful voices and playing with them and seeing over time, because we've been doing this work for a while now, just their sense of well-being and also physical health and seeing that improve and seeing them grow.
And they're really appreciative, aren't they?
They're wildly appreciative. I mean, there's a kind of gratitude that they express that I can't really describe, but it just cuts through your heart and you feel it. And they feel such a strong bond to who we are. You know, I mean, they know me now, but they also know that I represent my community, and they get that.
Wonderful.
And they know there's a connection to another community that they'll never see somewhere in the United States. And they feel it, and they feel like they know us. And it's quite powerful.
Isn't that wonderful? Wouldn't it be good to have some of our kids go over there and get the reality check and, you know, pen pals or something?
Yeah, well, we're actually, it's funny that you mentioned that because I have some people that I took with me this past summer, and they're starting a pen pal program I don't have time to do that. And
I think that's an excellent idea, because we, you know, here we are worried about the right kind of genes and all this other stuff, and, you know, I think it's great to, you know, get connected.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm also bringing next summer a group of students from our local university as well to give them a reality check.
I think that's wonderful. Do you have, I think I remember from the, you did a fundraiser that was really fun. A fundraiser, maybe it was, eh? And, I forget. Oh, yes, that you were having, you were working with the University of Western Washington.
Right.
To bring people into service, and I can't remember what it was they were doing. Is that the same group?
Yeah, that's the group I'm planning on bringing this summer to do service at one or two of our project sites for a month.
So I'm going to jump around. I'm excited about your project, very much so. I wanted to get you on the air for that reason. But, you know, I'm an intuitive, right? So I'm going to ask you a few other things. I'm looking at your, can I just read about you a little bit?
Sure.
Well, I'm looking at your soul journey, and I realized that you have been, like, literally, because we were talking in the show before this about people's soul journey and how there's some drives and fulfillments you really can't escape, or else it's really hard to escape, without getting very, very sick or whatever. But I look at you, and I see this wonderful kind of light that's been pushed, and you've had help from the other side. This is how it looks to me, to push you into alignment with some of this. And it's kind of uplifting for me. It's like you're a really loving soul, and you're going, well, here I go, you know. That you pretty much had to do it. Does that make sense to you?
Well, you know, yeah, I don't know what makes sense. I mean, I have to admit that. But, you know, I'll tell you a little secret, which I don't really usually say about this work, because I have to, you know, our mission is about AIDS, and we're addressing the attenuating issues that underlie this huge, you know, global emergency, which is, you know, quite serious. I don't want to underestimate it.
Oh, no.
It's creating so much suffering. But really, really, truly, what our work is about is love. And that's, you know, if I go around saying that, it ends up being sentimental and you get made fun of or whatever. But it's really about loving equally other people without question, you know. And through that love, just like, you know, when we're loved, you know, that feeling of support that you get to have the life that you're really meant to have. And we're not about going in from above and saving Africa, because it doesn't really need to be saved. We're just creating friendships with people, and along the way, we're, you know, just like you would have friends here, if you were in a difficult situation, they would help you.
That's right.
And that's what we're doing.
That's wonderful. What do you think? What do you think started the whole thing? Whether that's a relevant question or not, I'm thinking back for a minute, Tim. In 1987, you know who Carolyn Mace is?
Yeah.
She did wonderful. I don't know if you ever heard them tapes that I heard on AIDS and spirituality.
Yeah.
And she did a lot of work healing with people with AIDS, mm-hmm. and these approaches that she was using. And was drawing in a lot of information that people were dealing. It's kind of a cleansing process of being victimized, and I don't remember all the details now. I don't know if you do. Do you?
Well, I remember a little bit back then, because at the time when I was sick, I went to this beautiful center called the Manhattan Center for Living that was started by Marianne Williamson, and
wonderful.
And I think that Carolyn Mace at the time, you know, was someone that might have come in. And so, I mean, I was aware of her. I can't give you details. Though.
Well, she shook me to the core, because I was just I was an intuitive by then,
uh-huh.
But I'm still very, very interested in the healing, and how the healing often has a lot to do with our own empowerment and our soul journey and so on, for people to last in it. they really have to deal with some underlying issues. And they may not even be conscious of those. I know that. A lot of healings go on that people are not conscious of. But I kind of think about beautiful Africa. I was in Africa years ago. I think I told you this. I hitchhiked through Africa when I was 21.
No, you didn't tell me.
I was so in love with it.
You brave
soul. I think maybe I was stupid. You know when you're young and
yeah.
you think you're safe and you're powerful, and that's the way. I had my backpack and a couple of friends, and you know. But the thing is, it was so magnificent, and I just resonated with it. But that was 1965. Things have changed a lot then, and I also knew I would live there by choice, except I was the wrong color. I was on the wrong side of their ease at the time, if you know what I mean. They had to take over their own countries. But I loved Africa. I went off into a tangent, I'm sorry.
Well, I can see why. It's a really magical place.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I've often wondered why, it hasn't been... I don't know. I just wondered, what do you think started it all, and why on earth did it have to take over so much of Africa?
Yeah. What started?
AIDS. There are some theories that it came from some people, some germ warfare. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, I disavow that, and there's no proof of that. But I think there's some evidence, to be scientific, HIV is a virus. It's a retrovirus, and viruses across species typically. So there is evidence now.
It came from the monkey.
Yeah,
right?
Across mm-hmm. from monkeys to man. And,
do they feel like that's true still?
Yeah, a lot of scientists do.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's. We all know how it spread. It spread in the case of Africa sexually. In our country, there's IV drug use, and then in Africa, there's mother-to-child transmission.
And what about Haiti? It's really strong in Haiti, isn't it?
Haiti still has a problem, yeah, with HIV. It was one of the places in the early days of AIDS in this country where. I remember living in New York City, and there was that same kind of hysteria around the Haitian community in New York City, and also gay men, and they were the two pariahs of the world at the time. And but it's still, yes, a problem in Haiti as well.
I want to go back into the programs that you're putting together. A lot of it requires education, doesn't it?
The programs that we have?
Yeah, just about everywhere you look, it's going to have to be about education, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, education for me is something that I think is essential. You know, I'm going into another culture and working with a culture that I don't know and I'm not familiar with. Certainly, I learn some things over time, but. If you're not born there, you can't really understand it, and I know that, and so I know what I don't know, but I think
that's half the battle, Tim, isn't it?
But I think education is one of those universal truths or principles that everyone has the right to, and it promotes, you know, your own sense of yourself, and then. Democracy, and now Kenya's dealing with, I think a struggle with their own democracy because they just had recent elections, and they are in a crisis right now because of that. But education.
I heard their election was rigged. Boy, that's unusual, isn't it? That's me being cynical, right?
Yeah. But so we're about education, of course, because if that can create a better destiny for the people that we serve, it has to, you know, and especially girls, I feel really strongly. I mean, at some point I want to work more with men too and then bring the two genders together and see what happens. But we're working with girls because they've been at the greatest disadvantage in that culture. And their sense of empowerment you know, has been diminished. So we're just offering that education for the obvious reasons that girls can have a better sense of when they greater decision-making power, or you know, opportunity to be self-sufficient financially, possibly at some point, et cetera, that they can avoid getting married young.
But that again is kind of breaking out of their own cultural traditions, right?
Yeah, but it's at their invitation.
Good. That's
that they want it. So believe you me.
Yeah. Oh, and actually,
these are some really strong young girls, but they're held down by their culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard some pretty interesting stories about. Well, I guess I won't go into all that, but young girls escaping clitorectomies and all that, and having no home to go to, and that's a whole other thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's not in every female circumcision isn't in every country or every tribe, but it does exist in Kenya, and I've been in a Maasai village. It was a really fascinating experience, and did have a conversation around that with some men, and it was something that they're starting to address in their own, in their particular village, and they have a way of addressing community issues. They do it publicly with the elders. They're kind of the original conflict resolution model, it sounded like, as it was described.
Wonderful.
And the women are bringing it to the elders. And they're not willing to bend, it sounded like. This was this summer, but when we had this conversation, to really give in on it yet. But, you know, it's just that's the first step in that process, and I think that will change over time.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So the education is coming toward you as well.
Oh, much more towards me.
Well, I love
kidding?
That. That's a wonderful reciprocity. Yeah. I noticed also you're educated. You're going into the university in Bellingham, and this is on AIDS education, or this is just on the AIDS in Africa, or what are you doing there?
What do I do there? I work there, and I'm the director of the Center for Service Learning. And what we do as a center is promote the ethic of service and actual service for university students in the community. So we link students across all departments and disciplines to service projects in the community, mostly with local nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do is create an international service learning program, because I, as you can imagine, am a big proponent of seeing how other cultures live and being humbled by, you know, I think, I don't think our country is a humble country. And
no, I don't think it is either.
Yeah, we're kind of the alpha dog, and it's our way or no way. And we promote that, you know, and I think we assimilate that even if we're thinking people, and it's, and it's,
so it's like when you go to Africa, you sit in a village and learn what their style of leadership is and how they hear their people and how they resolve conflicts. That's very different than coming over as the alpha, isn't it?
And I'm also a minority. And I'm not a minority in my country.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be turned on your head by race, I think is a really powerful experience. And for me, and I'm hoping to do this with the students that I bring, you have to face all the things that, all the doors that open, all the things you take for granted because of your privilege, race, class, whatever it is in this country. And it's pretty much, I mean, obviously we have our marginalized, disenfranchised, poor people in this country, but we're pretty much handed privilege by being born here. And then you're in, you know, for me it's Kenya, and you don't know who you are. You don't know what your identity is all of a sudden.
Wow.
And that is really good.
So what happened when you had to go through that the first time?
The first time, you know, I confronted my racism.
Good.
And I'm one of those liberal, I thought I was one of those liberal white guys, and I went to an alternative college, and I have lots of friends of all kinds, but I'm willing to admit, and I'm not ashamed of it, that I took on the stereotypes, and I learned the stereotypes growing up in this country
mm-hmm.
about black people.
Wow.
And I was so disappointed with myself and ashamed. And when I was, and this was in South Africa, and you would think by, you know, living half a life already that I would have really confronted these issues for myself, and I hadn't. And I never really had the opportunity, I think. And it was having to do with being the minority and the thoughts that I had around people of color. You know, I would never act on them, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think having the thoughts, you have to find a way to eliminate them. You know, to really be a full human being and to really accept other people for who they are. So that was the beginning of me doing that, and I really want to promote that.
It's a real initiation, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it was really painful.
Well, it's interesting because as you say that, I go, I wonder where I am in all that. I don't know. I feel you said confront. I'm going, I'm not sure until you're in that experience do you actually know what's going on inside of you.
Right.
You know?
Right. And, you know, and it's a lifelong process. And we don't want to beat each other up over it. But we don't want to avoid it either.
How interesting. So, you know, there's something else that you spoke about that other time that I saw you, and it was that people are very uneducated about AIDS these days. They think it's over because the crisis of the 80s doesn't seem to be quite as flamboyant as it was, right?
Yeah.
So do you have anything to say about that?
We had the very strong visual at that time of people dying in front of us and in our arms and over again. And going to a lot of funerals. So, you know, I'm, as I said, in middle-aged, and I'm now working with people who are half my age, and they have no memory of this disease, and bless their hearts, you know, but it hasn't gone away, and they also have come of age in a world that has HIV and rampant sexually transmitted diseases, and they have to negotiate their intimate relationships from the moment they reach adulthood. But I don't think that message, I mean, that's the reality, but I don't think that message is really, really reaching them. And the, you know, that fault lies in our education systems and also, I think, in our families and the media. Who have kind of, you know, we have very short attention spans. So this topic is...
out of sight, out of mind,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
So what are you doing about it? Aren't you setting up some kind of... I thought you were setting up some kind of teaching system or tools or workshops or paperwork or something.
Oh, we have... one of the programs, the Slum Doctor program, is besides the work that we do in Africa... We've developed a global HIV/AIDS curriculum for the public schools, and it's not a, you know, straightforward sex ed.
You mean for here or
yeah,
for all
for,
anywhere?
Yeah, for Bellingham.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who listens to your program, but you know, it's
I think we'd be surprised who listens. I'm never sure, but we certainly can be global. We have calls from Spain and England, and
oh,
my
wow.
gosh, you know. So.
But our education program is just for our community, and we've created it to talk about global AIDS and really my hidden agenda. And we talk about Africa primarily because that's our expertise, and why HIV has, you know, wreaked havoc on this continent, et cetera, why women are at greatest risk. And we talk about poverty and other things. So, but my hidden agenda really is just to bring up the topic of AIDS, so that it doesn't, the flame doesn't get extinguished, and that if maybe at some point young people will remember what they heard and consider it for their own lives. And when they do have to make that negotiation with a sexual partner, possibly, or whomever, you know, so they think about it for their own life. Because really, we're all at risk still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And there of course, as we know, there are ways to minimize or prevent that risk. But it's not an intellectual process. Usually,
so are you installing that kind of programming in schools, in the schools in Africa as well? Or?
Well, no, we're just doing it in the middle and high schools here, and certainly we've had conversations with the people that we serve in Africa, but I have to say that in my experience in Kenya, the Kenyans are very savvy, and they know how you get AIDS. And they...
That's exciting to hear that they're very savvy about it, because we often hear, or stuff I've read says sometimes they just don't seem to understand that.
Right. That has not been my experience, and I will also say that there are more
I'm
public...
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And there are more public messages about HIV and AIDS than I have seen in the last 5 years in this country. I mean, it's the topic has now come to the fore. But what the problem is that when you're living in extreme poverty, your decision-making is not based on, you know, your sort of abstract intellectual information that you have about a certain disease. If you're a mom, who's a single mom, who's trying to feed her children, and you take a bus to go to a town to look for work, and you actually don't have bus fare. You have bus fare there, but maybe not bus fare to come home. And you can't get off the bus until you provide a sexual favor for the bus driver.
Oh, example. You're kidding. No way.
And I've heard these stories. So, or in the area that we work in, which is along Lake Victoria, I mean, this is a really bizarre and kind of unbelievable story. But the men are the fishermen, the women are the fishmongers, and the fish population in that lake is being depleted, and the lake is actually dying. Most of the fishermen are, as I said, are men, and they have AIDS, and they are sicker and weaker, and they can't go out deeper into the lake because they don't have the strength. So they're getting less fish in the shallow areas of the lake. So a lower fish population, they're not fishing as much. They're bringing in less fish. There are more women looking for work as fishmongers. And so they trade sex to compete for the with the men for the fish.
Oh my!
And you know, and unprotected sex in because condoms are hard to get, and for other cultural reasons, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, just to give you a couple examples.
That's a really sad story.
Yeah. So it's not that they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They're just trying to survive.
Yeah.
And and that's not going to be your priority,
right,
if, as I said, you're feeding your kids or yourself.
So do you have any good examples of, not good, but ones that are a little more inspiring of people that have grabbed hold of some of your services? And
yeah, well, we, in our boarding school for girls, that program is 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Or 2.5 years old now, and we've graduated 15 girls.
Great.
I'm happy to say.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them received a scholarship to get a college education abroad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where? Where's she going to go?
I just got that information, and I don't know yet.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if it's the U.S. or Britain. And then, I don't know, this is just my little simple joy. We have a preschool that we work with in a remote village in Kenya, and it was started by a wonderful, strong, loving woman to address the orphan population in her village of 3,000 people. And that was 4 years ago almost, and she started with 25 kids, and now there are 160 children.
Hmm.
Most, and about 100 of them are orphaned in this nursery school. So just to give you the scale, in a village of 3,000 people, that there are 100 orphan children between the ages of 2 and 5
wow.
at the school, and that's just that age group. But when I first went there 2 years ago, I just heard, you know, knew about it, and I wanted to visit, and I went to see the work. And here's this amazing, loving place, and the community has come together to support these kids, and they're, however, covered with ringworm.
Oh my!
Coughing, crusty, snotty eyes and nose, and they're getting one bowl of millet every day at the school, and they're there from 8 until 2. And they look malnourished and, you know, just, but not, but they're being loved, you know, so that was the positive part. So I just said, all right, we can feed them. We can feed them. We can give them a balanced diet. We can add protein and vegetables and dairy to their diet, and we can feed them 2 meals a day. So will you accept our offer? And so I go back a year later, and they are different kids. I swear.
Wow.
I mean, I can just give you the visual.
Wow.
But their skin is shining and clear, and they're not coughing, and they don't look sick, and the ringworm is cleared up, and okay. their hair is thicker, and their eyes are brighter, and it's just the best.
It's wonderful. Now, we're going to have to end in a few minutes, so I want you to say, like, who volunteers with you? I know you go with a team of volunteers. Who volunteers? Are all Bellingham people, or...?
They have been, and you know, we're a small organization, and we obviously can't support financially volunteers to go over. So people that feel so strongly about the work that we've done have gone with me, and they've raised their own money to do it.
Excellent.
And to support their own experience. And it's been wonderful to see, for me, to see our work through the eyes of people that have never seen it before. And to see how they connect as deeply as I've connected with the work, and then they come home and they can share that experience with the rest of the community.
And like many of these things, it's very, very life-changing for them as well. Give your website again, and so if anybody wants to either sign up or send money or keep in touch with what Tim's up to with Slum Doctor.
Great, and our website is www.slumdoctor.org. And I can't believe we talked for an hour. That was so fast.
We have many questions to ask you yet, but I'll keep in touch as well. So thank you ever so much, Tim Costello with Slum Doctor. And we'll talk soon. A wonderful paradigm shifter you are, mister.
Thank you, Veronica. It was a joy.
And me too. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Veronica Entwistle. That was our paradigm shifter for today. And next week's paradigm shifter are going to be two of them, actually. One of them is Janice, and I can't remember her last name. Forgive me, Janice. And she's a young woman as a healer, and she has her own little institute over there in Marin, and she works with Theta Healing. And we're going to talk to her and maybe even take callers about Theta Healing and what that's all about. The other half, and I'm still working on this, is Jill Ruttenberg, who has a wonderful healing center in Costa Rica. Jill's a massage person, very much an American, And she went over to Costa Rica wanting to do a retreat center, a healing center. And boy, it's an amazing place. So I would really like to talk to her about what it's been like to go there and the amount of healing that she's learned. She knows she's an herbalist. She's a master herbalist, knows about horses and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it would be fun. She's a dear old friend of mine to introduce her to all of you and have all of you talk to her. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you ever so for listening, and I want to send all of you blessings because we're wanting to shift the collective. We want to raise our field so that we're living in peace, in love, and really sending light to one another around the world. And our paradigm shifters are doing such a great job. They're just sending a wave of change through our collective. If you'd like to be in touch with me, it's Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com, E-N-T-W-I-S-T-L-E.com. I love it when I get feedback from the shows, suggestions about what you'd like to hear, even questions about your own world. So please email me, Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com. And I will be speaking to you next week. Oh, no, I'll be on Jackie Salvitti's show at 8 o'clock on Thursday night. We're still talking about the shadow. Jackie and her ET team, we're going to be talking about the shadow, and we're going to be talking about you. So tune in, and that's at 8 o'clock here on BBS Radio, West Coast time, that is. And then I'll see you on Radiance by Design next Tuesday at 4 p.m. West Coast time. Much love to all of you, and many blessings.